Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager. Carolyn Yeager brings you news and commentary on Holocaust revisionism, World War II history, free speech issues, and more. And now, here's Carolyn.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is Carolyn Yeager, live on Monday, November 28th. We are now between two major American holidays, heading into the biggest of all. This is the time of year when politicians, or those running them, like to sneak in unpopular legislation and get it passed. The kind of legislation that people later on scratch their heads over and wonder how it ever happened. Distraction is in the form of circuses, and it's time-honored method for getting things past the people, and Christmas has become just one more circus, shopping and partying, cooking and eating, well, not for everyone, but in the general society. No matter how we talk otherwise, Christmas ends up being all about money. We talk of remembering the real meaning of Christmas. Well, we should. That means to me finding that brilliant star to guide my steps and walking steadfastly along that path. Let's have a white Christmas this year, meaning let's think about our white culture, our white racial brethren, and how we can bring blessings to ourselves. But back to money. Money, its uses and abuses, the value it actually has in our society, is my underlying topic tonight. So keep that in mind no matter what I seem to be talking about. I'm going to start out talking about donations. Everyone on the internet, is asking for donations, and I'm not sure, but this may be the time of year that people give the most because they're in an atmosphere of festivity and goodwill and maybe they've saved up for it. I really don't know, but I usually think of giving to a couple of places that I have come to really like during the year at this time myself. Now, I'm not asking for money tonight, but I am going to say this. If you want to support the work that I do, which will be very clear from tonight's broadcast, if it isn't already clear to you, in distinction to what others are doing, then send your money directly to me and I will put it to work for that purpose. To donate directly to Carolyn Yeager, you have to use my PayPal account at Carolyn@CarolynYeager.com, all lowercase. I think that's how it is. I think you have to have that Carolyn at, unless maybe it's, you just say CarolynYeager.com, but you go to PayPal and send funds, you know, click send funds and then, put that in and, you'll come to it. Now, I don't want, though, people to send anything to me that they need for themselves. I'm not big in asking for money. But my point here is that there's a lot of money that passes around. There's a lot of money that goes to a lot of people in this movement, and generally, broadly speaking, in this movement. I think that what I would do with it is more valuable than what they're doing with it. So I'm just, that's why I'm putting this out there tonight since I have a little time to talk about it. If you want to support Voice of Reason Network, or if you want to support CODO, Committee for Open Debate of the Holocaust, under whose auspices I run the Elie Wiesel Kanza World website, by all means do so. I hope you do. Just realize that the money is going to be put to work quite differently depending on where it goes. So I'm going to begin now tonight with, first I'm going to take a little drink of water. I'm going to begin tonight with the European debt crisis again. First I'm going to give some background of where we are. on Thursday. I think this background is very important, and I think everything I'm going to say tonight is very important in discussing the whole idea of why we're in a culture of money and what this culture of money is doing to us. Now, but mostly to understand this European debt crisis, I think takes quite a bit of a repeat going over for most of us to really grasp it. And what a terrible scam is going on here. Now, let me continue. On Thursday, in the 23rd, Thanksgiving Day here, in Der Spiegel, this is from Der Spiegel, there was an article, and in this article, every day they have an article about this, they have this, I have this taken down. J.P. Morgan economist David Mackey wrote a research note arguing that the Eurozone ultimately needed to adopt Euro area bonds or face breakup. Okay, this is the threat that's coming. You know, if they, he is saying, of course, he's the J.P. Morgan guy. He is saying, what they really want to do is get to these euro bonds. This is what Angela Merkel is, and the Germans are refusing. They're refusing to go there, but they have allowed themselves to go up, 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 every step of the way, up to euro bonds, saying, "Well, this is where we will not go." But now the pressure is on them to go here. So he's saying that the if without euro. Zone without the accepting the euro bonds, European Union will break up. Well, okay. He says this is where the discussion is likely to go in the coming weeks and months. He's right about that. The EU Commissioner for Economic and Monetary Affairs, it says in this article, Olli Rehn, said bonds will only make sense once the 17 countries in the eurozone were on the same page in terms of economic governance and stability. That could be years. He says, without such underpinnings, the bonds would quickly become junk. Well, the 17 countries in the Eurozone are not on the same page, and they're not going to get on the same page unless there is one European dictator, so to speak, you know, one European government that forces everyone, that everyone is under. Every nation is under without any sovereignty of their own. That's how that will happen. But he says without that, the euro bonds would quickly become junk because, there's no, because the euro bond idea all depends on Germany. You know, they want the euro bonds because in Germany is going to be responsible, is going to be the final payer. When nobody else can come up with, you know, when nobody else has any money. So now this is the one thing that, that the Germans have been demanding from the over indebted countries, which are the southern and mixed race nations. That's what I call them. For example, Greece, Italy, Spain, and Portugal. They are demanding that, what these over indebted nations are actually refusing to do. The people are refusing. The leaders agree to the austerity, knowing that they're not the ones who will feel the pinch. But the people are unwilling, as they've shown in their various expressions of resistance in the form of riots and work closures and so on. So this is an impasse. And what we're dealing with here, I say, is we're dealing with racial realities that cannot, though, be mentioned. I mean, what we're dealing with is, once again, race, the reality of race, and that is not allowed to be mentioned. And so, therefore, we're living in a fairyland. People are being told things, people are being promised things, which they cannot deliver. And these leaders are telling their people things that they should never, promising them things that they should never promise them. As my guest Bill Fink and I said last week, and I said in the September Heretics Hour program, you can't make the Europeans equal. They are very unequal. But this is acknowledged. At the same time, the reality of it is ignored in some idea that they can join together if they're if they're not allowed to express their nationhood, which we're going to see coming up here. So just if they're needed, some examples of public resistance to austerity. I think most of you know that workers at Greece's biggest power plant, power producer, protested against the new property tax. Portuguese workers staged a 24-hour general strike. Fitch downgraded Portugal's rating to junk status. And they're threatening to downgrade France's rating. And France is quite upset about that. That's why it wants guarantees from Germany, as far in the form of euro bonds, to support the entire European Union. So, and then another thing that was said in this article is keeping, and here's a statement, keeping Italy solvent and able to borrow on capital markets is vital to the sustainability of the eurozone. Now, how are you solvent by being able to borrow money? This is what solvency has come to mean. Solvency means being able to borrow. That's not solvency, in my understanding. But we've been taught that for about 50 years now, with the idea that as long as you can pay off the interest on your credit, no matter how high it gets, you're still solvent. All right. Now, on November 24th, the following day, Der Spiegel had another article. Now, this is really the good one. Europeans, they say in this, Europeans are searching for an idea. This was the kind of the theme of the article. It's like, oh man, an idea nation. That's what they call the United States now. You know, we're here in the United States, we're an idea nation or a concept nation. We're not a nation based on an indigenous population. And, they say, what should the Europe of the future look like? Now, you see, they're like designers. They're designing, they're standing apart from the people, and they're designing what Europe is going to be. There will be no more referendums. You can believe that. They don't want to know what the people think, because they know what, they know that the people don't want what they're designing. But they're trying to create an idea group. It's not a nation, but an idea unified Europe that they will call a federation of European nations. How will that function? This is what this article is asking. How could a working government in Brussels be structured? Brussels. You know, I hate Brussels, Belgium, where all of this is centered. Why? This tiny little country, Belgium. I don't like the Belgians because they seem to be all socialists there, and they want this united Europe, and they don't have to do anything for it. I mean, they're not a major country. They don't have much to offer it. But they want to be offered something from the rest. So anyway, they say, could a continent-wide democracy foster unity and solidarity among European nations? Here's the thing. What is a continent-wide democracy? When you read this further, we find they've given up on national democracies. Because they don't want nationalism. They don't want nations because the nations are not cooperating properly because they want to continue with some of their sovereignty, and they don't want to let them have any more sovereignty. So they say the dream of a united Europe will remain vague as long as the European governments try to promote integration by way of intergovernmental agreements. Okay. As long as Europe is shaped by national leaders, they will always focus exclusively, or at least primarily, on the people whose interests they are sworn to represent, their voters. So here you have, we can't have a Europe shaped by national leaders who are going to be responsive to the people of their nation who they are sworn to represent. We know that in the United States now, We have that already. Our leaders and our representatives and senators and so on, all the people who we vote for to represent us, don't represent us. Some people still want to believe that they do, or they should be writing to them and asking them to do so. But I think when they get to Washington, they're told, well, you know, we're in a new time, and, you know, we have to use this rhetoric for the people back home. We have to keep them comfortable and make them believe that we're, you know, that we're listening to them. But that doesn't work because it's too divisive. We don't get anything done. And so we just decide for ourselves. And then these senators and representatives, they don't even make their own decisions themselves. They are told by the technocrats or by the real rulers, the bankers and the financiers and so on, how it's going to be. And they go along with it. They have to go along with it, or they won't be reelected. They'll see that they won't get reelected. So we do not have this representation here in the United States. And this is, they want the same thing for Europe. And for them to say that as long as Europe is shaped by national leaders, they will always focus exclusively or at least primarily on the people whose interests they are sworn to represent as something that cannot remain is really amazing. You know, it's amazing. And this is what the kind of stuff they write in Der Spiegel and in all of these, most of these articles, they put it out there. You see what they're doing. I mean, they don't lie about it actually, because they have to. They're pushing along in this way, and they tell you what they're doing. But people don't read it or don't understand what they're reading, or are confused by it. So now the article goes on. This is the real drawback of all models that are based on increasingly close cooperation among European governments. The fact that they're ultimately answerable to voters at home. They don't want that. As long as Europe's democracies are organized and oriented on a national basis, citizens will never be able to look beyond the confines of their own countries. You see, so now, again, it's very, very clear that in Europe, the plan is that people will not be members of their own country, and they will not think of themselves as these various, you know, Germans and French and Poles and Spaniards and so on. They have to make this adjustment to seeing themselves as Europeans and forget all about that national ethnicity that they have, or that national race even, because in many cases it is more like a race. And here they have, in a survey by the YouGov Opinion Research Institute, it says 2/3 of Germans were opposed to providing aid to Greece or other countries. So that's bad. That's bad. They don't want that. They need to change this thinking, or they just need to make it impossible for people, for the Germans to say what they want. Then they go on to say peace, freedom, and prosperity for all Europeans. It's not a concept that is very appealing in the national marketplace of ideas. So, you know, what does peace, freedom, and prosperity for all Europeans mean? Well, that's a communist concept. That's socialist communism. That's a utopianism also, that you can have peace, freedom, and prosperity for all Europeans. That's very much like the slogans or the statements, that became famous, the lingo for the First World War, the Second World War. Every war has something like that, saying what it's being fought for. You know, the war to end all wars and the war to guarantee democracy all over the world and so on never happens. It's nonsense. And so is this peace, freedom, and prosperity for all Europeans. But this is what they want the people to accept and believe in, so that everybody as a European will support all Europeans. Now, it gets even worse here, because now they mention a European thinker Jürgen Habermas. That's the man that William Fink brought up last week. And I'm going to say they have a whole article about him that I'll get into shortly. But Jürgen Habermas, he says that under the EFSF regime, rich nations are being held accountable for the debts of poor countries for the first time. And this is a paradigm shift which subjects European cooperation to a stress test of unknown proportions. So think about this. What this means is that working people have to support the people who buy the products they produce. That's what it means. Rich nations are going to be held accountable for the debts of poor countries. An example of this is China and the United States. Let's say that China is selling stuff to the United States, but U.S. citizens become too poor to buy the Chinese products that we've been buying. And so, therefore, for China to make sure that U.S. People, citizens, continue to buy their products, they have to support the U.S. citizens. They have to make sure that they have the money to buy their products. Otherwise, they won't be able to sell their products. You see the kind of a problem that this gets into. And this is what they're planning for Europe, that somehow they're going to force those who still have some money and are the ones, or they're going to force the ones who are selling, which is Germany. Germany sells a lot of products into the European Union countries. And that's one thing they hold up against Germany. They say if it collapses and everybody's broke, then you won't have anybody buying your products and you'll be broke too. Well, that's all very true. But then for some reason, the Germans are supposed to support the people in these countries by giving them bailouts and so on, so that they can keep buying from them. This is something that is in the realm of craziness or Alice in Wonderland, yet it's being talked about in these newspapers and magazines and by these important people who are supposed to know so much. Now, the EFS, I want to clarify, is something that's been was authorized by the European Union, the European Eurozone, to be able to issue bonds or other debt instruments on the market to raise funds needed to provide loans to Eurozone countries in financial troubles, and also to recapitalize banks or buy sovereign debt. Now, there was not enough money put into this. I mean, they thought they put enough money into it, but it was always coming up short because more and more countries were getting into financial trouble and needed loans. So then they created the ESM, which is currently in operation, called the European Stability Mechanism. And it's a permanent bailout fund, which was the previous one was supposedly temporary. You know, they set it up, but for the time being because of the crisis. But now they've made it permanent, and Germany accepted this in order to avoid euro bonds. But now they're pushing, now this is not enough, so now they're pushing euro bonds on Germany anyway. You see how this works. You're never going to, none of these things are ever going to be enough, and euro bonds won't either. In fact, if euro bonds become a reality, Germany will collapse itself. And that's why, you know, eventually, and that's why they don't want them. But there's such irresponsibility here. Such incredible irresponsibility that they're pushing this anyway. Sarkozy's pushing this to save his own little country's current crisis. They just push it off to the future. Now, they admit that this ESFS or EFSF was a also called the transfer union. And I guess the ESM is also. It's a transfer union, but they admit that it's not just a temporary solution. They say it says right here, no, in this article, no matter how big the bailout fund gets, Some countries in the Eurozone will continue to suffer from poverty and underdevelopment. And then they say social justice. See, they're using economics to create social justice. This is communism, pure and simple. Social justice can only be achieved on the European level if the losers are allowed to permanently share in the profits of the winners. What does this mean? You know, the winners, the wealthy are going to support the poorer. The winners are going to support the losers. They're going to give them part of their profits. This is what is meant by it. And a citizen of Europe equals communist enslavement. I'm saying this is my comment. It's good for the poor, or the inferior poor, bad for the superior rich. Another comment I have here is letting the Jewish bankers back into Germany is what has brought this about, which goes back to Adolf Hitler, who got the Jewish bankers out of Germany and would have gotten them out of Europe had he been allowed to. All right, ladies and gentlemen, I'll continue after.
We'll be right back with more on the Heretics Hour. You're listening to VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Welcome back. All right, let's switch gears and talk about Europe, because in Greece, we see striking power workers occupying a government building. The crisis does not end there. In Germany, a bond auction failed. More than a third of them had no buyers, and reportedly the German Central Bank had to pick up the slack. And so we just see more bad news for the Eurozone. Now, Eric Fry, our guest from earlier, editor of the Daily Reckoning, he has already said farewell to the Euro. In fact, he went to Europe to do it. Take a look.
What do you think about the European Union? Think it's a good idea or a bad idea?
Bad idea.
Bad idea?
Yeah.
Would you rather have the Gilder Pact, or you like having the Euro?
I like more the Gilder.
I think the European Union is going to change into the United States of Europe.
So will we see a United States of Europe? Or in the Western world of heavily indebted nations, are we all Greeks now? Are we all in this crisis? Well, let's ask Eric Fry. He is just the guy to answer that question. So, Eric, I want to bring you back in here. I want to first ask about that failed bond auction, this German auction from today, because there's really mixed reviews as far as if this is a big deal or not. But this is the worst bond auction that they've had of the failures. Are investors worried about Germany now?
Yeah, I don't know. They're not really worried about Germany. I don't believe that yet. But this is certainly, as I wrote last week, this is certainly a new chapter in the crisis, and it's a worrisome one. It's one thing when you have chronic deadbeats of Europe having problem. Mm-hmm. It's another thing when the core of the Eurozone is also having a problem. And last week we saw over the last two or three weeks we saw the French 10-year bond yield spread over German 10-year bond spread widen out dramatically, meaning that investors were dumping French government debt. Mm-hmm. And that was really a new chapter and a really scary one, because that says, look, this problem is now in the core of the Eurozone. So with today's failed auction, I don't know how much more core it could be than right there with a German bond auction that failed.
Yeah.
And yields spiked as a result. The yields spiked above U.S. Treasury 10-year yields for the first time in a while.
And that's
so, yeah, it's a worrisome sign.
And as you said, you know, you can't get more core than Germany. I actually want to bring in our producer, Dimitri Kofinas, because he has a question for you about this.
Hey, Eric, so sticking with the thing about failed bond auctions, about 2 weeks ago, roughly, we saw the EFSF, which is the bailout fund for Europe, issue about 3 billion euros worth of debt, and apparently it had to buy some of that debt. And the EFSF gets its backstop from the core of Europe, and it's incorporated in Luxembourg. So what does it say to you that, at this point, a Luxembourg corporation is responsible for bailing out the entire continent of Europe?
Thank you. Let's return to the Heretics Hour, brought to you by VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com. And now here's Carolyn.
Welcome back, listeners. I am Carolyn, and I've been trying to explain and give you some idea of what is really behind and underneath this European crisis that is being so splashed all over the media these days, and the crisis idea is really strong because these countries have gone way overboard, and now the whole debt thing has gotten so out of control that they can't put it back. They can't fix it really. And they keep going to more and more anti-nationalist measures and taking away more and more sovereignty from the nations of Europe. And that's the end goal anyway. Is to get rid of all nations that care about themselves and that have a sense of identity, and make them all global entities that have lost all that identity. So I was going to talk about a little bit about Jürgen Habermas. There's really not much to say about him. Before I do, I'm going to point out that this idea that so many of them have, that is being pushed, that the solution to Europe is that it become a United States of Europe, like the United States of America. And one fellow, this Verhofstadt, he's a Belgian, who is very pro-Euro Union, says that he uses this as a reason. He says, look at California, the biggest economy in the United States. It has enormous problems, and it can't even pay its civil servants. And why doesn't this put the dollar under pressure? Because California is part of the political union of the United States. So, you know, they want Europe to be a political union, not just an economic union. And when it's a political union, nations of Europe won't have any more power than the states in the United States have, which actually Bill Fink was talking about last week. But when we look here in the United States, California gets away with over-indebting itself and doesn't suffer as much as it should because it's a part of the United States, and everyone in the United States has to cover all of these problems and debts. So California can get away with irresponsibility, as it has been, and allowing all this immigration to come in, which has changed California and is the reason for its great indebtedness and overextension. So the rest of us are really responsible. We have our part in the responsibility for it. So as long as you still have a few solvent states and successful states, Texas is kind of one of them. It's considered one of them. Then these others can be as irresponsible as they want and not pay the price for it. And that's exactly what's happening in Europe. They want Germany, mainly, to be the one that's going to remain the responsible one, and so the others can be irresponsible. Now, Jürgen Habermas, who is considered, according to the communists and Der Spiegel, a great European, just the kind they like, they describe him as, he took his cultivated rage from Marx, his keen view of modernity from Freud, and his clarity from the American pragmatists. Well, you know, and then I'll add, he's a student of the Frankfurt School. He studied under Horkheimer. He's always been strongly anti-Nazi, and he's very pro-Jewish. I mean, he's terrifically comfortable with the Jews, and of course, in his anti-Nazi stance, the Jews were terribly victimized, and so they're great people as far as he's concerned. But he talks always about the global community, and when he talks about Europe, he talks about building a global community of citizens. So that's his deal. He also believes in the rationality of the people. This is all the people who are behind all this. They all think this way. Now, what is the rationality of the people? This is liberalism, you know, and when you put it on a global scale, you can't talk about the rationality of the people, and they don't care about the people. That's just words that they use. The people are ordered around and told what to do. These are all just big liars. I don't want to waste any more time on him. Yesterday, Paul Craig Roberts wrote a very rather startling column about the European Central Bank and the whole business in Europe. And I'm going to quote from it, one paragraph. He says here, the European Central Bank does not like being a lesser entity than the U.S. Federal Reserve and the U.K.'s Bank of England. The European Central Bank wants the power to be able to undertake quantitative easing on its own. That's what, if it was put in charge, as it wants to be, it would be able to function the same way. Right now, it's not able to do that. Now, going on with Roberts, the ECB is frustrated by the restrictions put on its powers by the conditions that Germany required in order to give up its own currency and the German central bank's control over the country's money supply. Now, Germany has been pushed along all along here, and it's finally put these restrictions on the ECB in order to give up its Deutschmark in the beginning. The agreement was that, see, there were a lot of agreements, and one by one, these agreements are being overturned. Not with a vote, but, well, I don't know if it's with a vote, but they get people to go along by making these agreements, and then they don't live up to the agreements, and pretty soon the agreement's been overturned. So he says that the EU authorities want more unity, by which is meant less sovereignty of the member countries of the EU. That's exactly what unity means. It means that. Germany, being the most powerful member of the EU, is in the way of the power that the EU authorities desire to wield. So Germany is being pressured to continue to be a money bags to as long as it can be, but to give up its position, its positions that it is trying to prevent losing what little power it has. So that's the German bond auction failure you may have read about. I hope you have. Roberts believes it was an orchestrated event to punish Germany and to warn the German government not to obstruct unity or loss of individual country sovereignty. Now, doesn't this sound familiar, my friends? They're punishing Germany. They're warning Germany. This can go back to the early Adolf Hitler Third Reich days when they went along with Germany for a while and what he was doing. But when they saw that he was not going to go along with them, then they finally came down on him. And this is what's going on now. And of course, Germany doesn't have the sovereignty that it had then. Germany is occupied by the United States and is really, and then I want to get into that so-called German constitution in the second hour. but Germany is being used and abused and misused, once again in the same way. Although it's a little bit different because this government has gone along with all of this, but they still are trying to kind of hold Germany together, but the idea is that it's not going to be that way. Now, today, Der Spiegel had an article, Eurozone on the Brink, and there's a quote here that's really amazing from a Jacques Attali, and he used to be an advisor to former President François Mitterrand of France, who was a socialist agnostic. Mitterrand was a socialist agnostic, naturally. And this Attali, paints the concerns of partner countries in a particularly drastic light. He says, after two world wars, it is now Germany once again that holds the weapons for the entire continent's suicide in its hands. If Germany doesn't change its position, says Attali, there will be a catastrophe. Well, I found this just, see the way this this verbiage is building up. You know, what nerve this guy has. This is the equivalent of name calling. He's saying, well, the Nazis are going to come in control again. You know, the Germans are once again behaving like the Nazis did. They hold the weapons for the entire continent's suicide. It means if Germany doesn't go along with what these socialists, communists want, then it's their fault when it all comes apart. And they're responsible for a catastrophe. They have done it again, just like they did it back in 1939. Oh, boy. You know, this is really some kind of stuff that's going on. But but the article goes on to say that a liability union, whatever it's called, a liability union, what they're calling this, would not only contradict the so-called no bailout clause of the European treaties. The treaties were that they weren't going to have bailouts. But it would also be particularly dangerous for the Germans. As Europe's largest economy, Germany would shoulder the biggest burden, and in the end could even be plunged into ruin with the rest of the Eurozone. This is where they are coming, you know, in a little part of the article. They're coming to Germany's defense a little bit here in Der Spiegel, simply pointing out they're not, they don't want this. They want the socialist communist thing to take place, but which they make clear later in the article. But here they're just pointing out why Germany doesn't want this, because it's very dangerous for Germany. And if the euro bonds go through, or any further business of this type, Germany can be plunged into ruin with the rest of the Eurozone. Now, how is that going to help Europe in the end? I suppose it's not supposed to. I suppose the whole idea is to destroy all of Europe, just like they're destroying the United States is being destroyed. And bankers then have the whole thing the way they want it, and the Jews. So I'm going to leave it at that for now, because I want to go on and talk a little bit about this neo-Nazi terror that is being also built up into a frenzy in Germany. And the one thing I want to point out about it is that they bring up the Office for the Protection of the Constitution, which is the domestic intelligence agency. You know, they have their internal security, which is in their language, for the protection of the Constitution, which monitors political extremism. Now, this town in what used to be Eastern Germany, where these so-called poor two guys and this woman were living and operating whatever they were operating, it's called, the way to pronounce it is Tick. Oh, now I don't have it in front of me. Here it is. Twicko. I was calling it Zwickau or something like that, or Twicko. It is apart from that town, these crimes that they call neo-Nazi crimes are crimes against the Constitution. That's what they call it. And it's so ridiculous, because Germany doesn't really have a constitution. As true Germans continually point out, they have something called the Basic Law, which was created by United States occupation government and the Jews that they had, you know, doing all this legal work there. And it's the German law specialist who worked with that. He gave a definition of it, which I don't have with me right now, but it's definitely not a constitution. It's some kind of a substitute temporary, some kind of a temporary substitute for a constitution. That's what the words mean. But it's still there. But they call it, you know, they just ignore all that. And they just keep calling it Germany's constitution. And these anybody who is questions, says anything against Jews or questions the Holocaust or is on the right wing, which is called neo-Nazi, then that's political extremism. Those are crimes against the Constitution. And it's kind of interesting when you read about that, because it's so, again, Alice in Wonderlandish. Now, they say, now, since this Zwickau affair that they're built up into some kind of neo-Nazi terrorist ring in Germany, I'm reading it again in Der Spiegel. There has been criticism of the fact that the different state-level branches of the agency appear not to have shared information with each other and with other authorities. Germany currently has 16 state-level domestic intelligence services, as well as the national agency, and there have been calls for some of those agencies to be merged. Well, this is exactly, friends, how we got the Department of Homeland Security after 9/11. And in fact, there are a lot of Germans now, and in the press, they're calling this Zwickau business Germany's 9/11. Unbelievable. 10 people, they're saying that these 10 people were killed by these guys that they call this neo-Nazi terror ring. But that still hasn't been proven. But since it's been put forth as a possibility, they think it's a likelihood maybe, now the press and everybody is just saying it like it's a fact, like they know. And you know why they can do that? Because these two guys are dead. Now, if these two guys were still alive and they were charged with these crimes, or they had been arrested and they were facing a trial. Of course, they don't have jury trials in Germany, but they were facing a trial. They couldn't say those things about them. But because they're dead, they just go on and, you know, accuse them of things that it's not been proven that they did. But another thing that likens it to 9/11 and Homeland Security that we got stupidly by allowing ourselves to believe in that 9/11 story that came out right away, and in all the rush and pressure and so on about, oh, what we needed to do for security, we ended up with that horrible cabinet department, which is terrorizing everybody. They also say here, the German Justice Ministry has confirmed that the German government was considering paying compensation to the families of the murder victims. The compensation would be set at around 10,000 euros per victim. Well, again, they're copying 9/11. Now, you know, does the German government pay compensation to the families of all murder victims? No. They're doing this to make these people special. They don't even know who killed them yet. But see, this again, the government is even going along with the idea that they're victims of these neo-Nazis. And here they say, following that, they say the Zwickau neo-Nazi trio is suspected of murdering at least 9 immigrants and a policewoman between 2000 and 2007. And they're suspected, and yet the media is putting it out as a fact. And this thing is growing. All the newspapers are going along with it. I think it's in part because of what's happening with the, I said this last week, but what's happening with the European Union and the failure of the liberal policies of the, they're really, there are a lot of communists in Germany high political positions. And, or you might, they call themselves socialists, I suppose, but they're just the same as communists. And they hate the right wing so much, and they are but they have failed with the European Union. All their policies, all their economic, everything they've done has failed and brought Germany to the state that it's in now, bailing out everybody and everyone. And so in order to cover themselves and distract attention from that, they are playing up this neo-Nazi thing, this little bitty deal that they managed to come up with, and playing it up for all it's worth. It is absolutely shameful and disgusting. Now, there's a story that these I'm only got a few more minutes in this first hour. There's a story now that came out that these neo-Nazi murderers, they're calling them now, Zwicko's neo-Nazi murderers, were trained in Bulgaria, and they say that they had visited Bulgaria shortly before their first murder, where we don't know if they committed a murder, and reportedly, here's the word reportedly, used the Balkan country for training. This is just a report, but they're publishing it. In the period between 98 and 2000, the notorious neo-Nazi trio traveled abroad on a couple of occasions, visiting Budapest and subsequently Bulgaria. Well, they probably were visiting comrades in those two cities, or those in Hungary and Bulgaria, because there are a lot of right-wing what are called neo-Nazis in those places, and they would go there probably if they went there. Why wouldn't they go there and meet with fellow comrades? Anyway, according to a German newspaper, it says they allegedly entered Bulgaria using false IDs and went through some sort of military training. I imagine that's not true. I doubt they had military training, but this was in that awful newspaper called The Local. Another thing that I want to bring up is that I think I have time, just have time to do it. There was a story today also in The Local that I saw, which is a horrible paper, which I think is, I'm sure The Local, it's a German, it's an English language German news, and then they have it in some other countries too. They, you know, Switzerland and Norway and so on, they have a version in all those countries. But I think Jews are behind it, because it's very anti-right wing. And they had a story, though, that a 13-pound baby was born, Muslim, who was named Jihad, J-I-H-A-D, you know, Jihad. The doctors were astounded because he set a new record for Germany's heaviest ever naturally born newborn, 13 pounds. He was named Jihad. His mother weighed 528 pounds. She's 40 years old, and she had gestational diabetes. And I cut off the part that said that she already has a family of like 14 children. I don't think that number 14 might not be exactly right, but it's something like that. I mean, nine of one sex and four or five of another. So she had all these kids, and now she gave birth. She's only 40 years old. And the name Jihad. Now, here I'm contrasting this to a story that has been in the news for a long time, but just recently it came back, that this family in New Jersey that named their son Adolf Hitler. And when they ordered a birthday cake for him, somebody, probably a Jew, called the authorities and said, oh, there's some people who have a child named Adolf Hitler. And they went to the home and they took all those kids. I think they had four children, three or four, this couple. And the others had kind of unusual Third Reich names, but nothing like Adolf Hitler, nothing that you couldn't live with. Anyway, they took these children away from these people, and they're still trying to get custody. Anyway, I think the woman was pregnant at the time, and they gave birth to a new child and their fourth child. So they only had three. And as soon as this boy was born, this new son of theirs was born, they named him Hans. He was taken from them hours after his birth by authorities in Neusser, New Jersey, I think. And there's no information given where they took him or where they anything. And these poor people, I guess a doctor, it says a doctor called authorities after the baby was born. See, there's so much hatred against these people because they named their son Adolf Hitler. And they make all this business outcry about how psychologically disabling this was for this boy, and that this was child abuse. But now here, this kid in Germany, is named Jihad, but they're not going to say a word about that. They won't say a word about that. If some kid in the United States was named Jihad, and if I called the authority and said, hey, there's a boy named, they named him Jihad, nothing would be done. This is the way things are skewed. And this, I think, is sad. And it. When we come back, we're going to have plenty of time. And we'll give the number when we get back. And I'm also going to come back.
We'll be right back with more on the Heretics Hour. You're listening to VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
From FSN, I'm Kate Moody with the latest world news. The United Nations has released a new report accusing Syrian military and security forces of committing crimes against humanity during the 8-month crackdown on anti-government protesters. While the document could increase international pressure on Syria, it could also prompt action by the UN Security Council, as Natalie Carney reports from New York.
The UN Commission of Inquiry on Syria interviewed more than 200 people for the report, compiling stories of civilian torture, rape, and murder by members of the Syrian military and security forces. While the report calls on Syria to halt gross human rights violations, the UN Security Council has yet to take action. In October, both Russia and China vetoed a resolution that would have condemned President Bashar al-Assad's handling of the crisis. Yet this new report could place further pressure on the Security Council to act. Meanwhile, on Sunday, the Arab League approved sanctions against their neighbor following mounting criticism by the international community over Syria's oppression of anti-government forces. More than 3,500 people have been killed during the 8-month crackdown on dissidents. Natalie Carney, New York.
Egyptians have flocked to the polls in the first parliamentary election since President Hosni Mubarak was ousted by mass protests in February. There had been fears the election would be delayed or even canceled by last week's violent protests against the interim military rulers. The vote itself was mostly peaceful, and thousands of Egyptian judges and international observers monitored the process. The Muslim Brotherhood is expected to win a stronger role in the new parliament. U.S. State Department spokesman Mark Toner said the high turnout was a step in the right direction.
This is about the Egyptian people. As we said last week, you know, as much as it's important to protest in Tahrir Square, the real future, democratic future of Egypt will be decided in the ballot box. And so as much as that message has been conveyed and the Egyptian people are now exercising their democratic right in a peaceful fashion that will lead to real democratic change in the long term for Egypt, that's a very good thing.
U.S. and EU leaders have pledged to work together to boost the global economy amid ongoing fears about the Eurozone debt crisis. European Council President Herman Van Rompuy, European Commission President José Manuel Barroso, and the EU's Foreign Policy Chief Catherine Ashton were in the U.S. Capitol for a wide-ranging summit that was all but overshadowed by the debt crisis. They vowed to work together towards a solution that would bind the 17 members of the Eurozone closer together and strengthen the single currency. But details remained scarce. President Barack Obama pledged to support the European leaders.
The United States stands ready to do our part to help them resolve this issue. This is of huge importance to our own economy. You know, if Europe is contracting or if Europe is having difficulties, then it's much more difficult for us to create good jobs here at home because we send so many of our products and services to Europe. It is such an important trading partner for us, and so we've got a stake in their success.
This is FSN. The Pakistan.
Let's return to the Heretics Hour, brought to you by VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com. And now here's Carolyn.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to our second hour of the Heretics Hour tonight. And I welcome callers if you have something of interest or worthwhile or pertinent to say. The number is 1-855-477-2283. There's a lot of what I covered that could be commented on, so feel free to call in and do so. Now, over the weekend, I read, finally, Hannah Reich's memoir, The Sky, My Kingdom. I'm a real fan of Hannah Reich. That's spelled H-A-N-N-A and last name R-E-I-T-S-C-H. She's a very well-known German pilot. She was a test pilot during World War II. She had several meetings with Adolf Hitler. She knew all of the top Luftwaffe commanders and generals and test pilot people and plane manufacturers and all the famous names. And she was very, very skilled pilot. And she started out as in gliding, and she was she won a lot of awards nationally and internationally, mostly internationally, as for her gliding in gliding competitions. And gliding was where there's no engine in the plane. You use the lift of the air currents that are pushing up. I learned more about it as I was reading the book, and I skipped some parts that I have to go back to because I wanted to make sure I got the ending read. But I wrote an article about her several years ago. In fact, I had to make some corrections in it yesterday because I found some things that I had picked up from here and there that weren't quite right, and just in one part of it. But glider planes were invented by the Germans, and only in recent times. They haven't been around for a long time, and I'm not going to go into all of that. But the Germans shared their planes plus their gliding skills and, you know, how to build the planes and everything that they knew about it with people in other countries. And this took place under the regime of Adolf Hitler. In January 1934, a new organization called the German Institute for Glider Research. This German Institute for Glider Research was not a government organization. But it had it was a private organization. And certainly such things were very possible in National Socialist Germany. People, had the right to do these things. And, they formed this, and they were asked to go to Brazil and Argentina and to put on gliding demonstrations for those who are interested. And they did go there. There was, maybe 10 or 12 of them in this group, maybe more. And Hannah Reich was among them. She was only like around 21 years old at the time. But she had started flying as soon as she was able, like around 18, and she made such tremendous progress because she just she was very talented and just kind of right for it. But also she worked very hard at it. And so in January 1934, they went and they stayed about they stayed until June, about 6 months, and it was all very successful, and she writes about that. And then in September 1934, the Finnish government invited a group of German glider pilots into their country to hold with the object of stimulating interest in gliding among Finnish youths. And I'm going to read from the book on page, if I can see it, on page, on a couple pages, because the way she writes about the Finns, how it comes across to me is the way that life, how life should be and how life can be among Europeans and how life can be among, among different peoples, where you're not, where the whole, everything is not controlled by bankers. So she says, we reached Finland in September, and apart from the well-known features of the Finnish lakes, its dense black forests, I was immediately struck by the intensity of the pure bright colors and by the wonderful clarity of light and air. But the country as a whole seemed to dwell in loneliness, silent as though guarding a secret. Well, then she goes into a little poetic stuff there, which I'll skip. But then she says, the Finns were like their country, taciturn, almost oriental in their reserve, forming a strangely affecting contrast with the Western civilization of their towns. They were also proud and honest and above all healthy. The Finnish people owe their health in the first place to their natural and simple style of living. They allow light and air to get to their bodies and reserved to sport a place of honor in their national life. There is hardly a village, school, or factory in Finland that does not possess the most modern and generous facilities for sport. A further cause of the astounding fitness of the Finns is that national institution, the sauna bath. Then on the next page, she says, I'll read this part. Though the Finns are small in numbers, they have a proud record of sporting achievement, and we found that, like the South Americans, they took to gliding with an eager enthusiasm, which showed itself not only in the large number of letters which we received during our visit and the even larger numbers that followed us home, but also in the warmth and appreciation with which speakers referred to our activities on a wide variety of official occasions. So it was that after our departure, a team of German technicians went over to teach the Finns how to construct training gliders and to help them set up the necessary workshops. Significant of the spirit in which the members of the Finnish government approached the whole question of gliding was their conviction that every village throughout the country should be encouraged to take it up, while the regulations which were issued covered the training of glider pilots, stipulated that an applicant must have put in at least 150 hours on glider construction before he could be admitted to training, and so on. So this is, you know, this just struck me as such a wonderful example of spontaneous or private sharing of your knowledge and your skills and your abilities between nations. And the Germans have always done that. They have always excelled in being a little bit ahead of things and then sharing it with others. They've always been willing to share it. And this is a way of life that was going on then. It went on under the National Socialist regime, which is presented as being the only thing that they want to talk about when they talk about National Socialism is the Gestapo, which wasn't the way that it's presented as being either. But you know, lots of good things were happening, and it was because all these good things were happening, and Germany was such a wonderful place at that time, where people had really come alive again after the terrible World War I and the Weimar regime, and so much enthusiasm was taking place in all their activities, and in 1938, also, Reich went to the United States with a group of flyers, and they did the same type of thing there. And she ran into some anti-German expressions against her and her team, but mostly she says she was well received, and I'm sure that's true. That most Americans were happy to see them and were positive toward them, but there were some that weren't because of all the anti-German propaganda that was already taking place, created by you-know-who. So this kind of civilization that we are losing now under this world globalist money system is what we need to remember. And just reading all through this book and what she wrote, which gives the character of how life was in Germany then, it just brings home what we have lost, what could be, and what has been destroyed and what is continuing to be destroyed until, if all these measures go through, if this debt system, this control of bankers in which everybody's going broke because they've got this crushing debt on them, that is created. I don't know how we ever got into it, but we did. And this has to be thrown off. And we have to see what's behind it. We have to stop this following after money. We have to stop this thinking that if the banks go under, if the loans aren't paid off, so what? We're still going to exist. We may have to fight off the non-whites that are in our white nations that come start rioting and tearing into us. We might have to do that, but it might not be as bad as they say. You know, it might not be that bad, and that's what we have to make sure that this is the way we go. We can't go along with these crisis threats, these fears that they throw up, that, oh, now we have to do this or everything will come apart. And that's what they're doing all over the place. I see it. I've been reading it all week in the U.S. Media, in the German media, of course, I'm reading also the German media that's for English-speaking people, but also in the German media for Germans. I mean, they just keep pushing this stuff. We really have to encourage the people we know not to believe it. I don't know. There are Germans. There are Germans who have, I don't know what happened to those quotes I had there, but who were saying that that the Eurozone should break apart, that Germany should go back to the Deutschmark, and they're giving scenarios of how that can happen. And there may be a plan for that. I don't know. I don't know what's going to happen, but I hope that's the way it goes. I really do. Now I'm going to quit this, and I'm going to go on to what I was going to talk about. The other thing, which if I can find it here now, because I moved it, about internet radio. Now I'm going to probably step on some toes, but I've got these darn things. I don't know who. Oh, that's well. I can't read these messages now. I'll wait for the break and I'll read them. So, internet radio. Okay. I did a program in September titled The Pitfalls of Internet Radio. Now, that was about my experience with Charles Giuliani on his radio show, but also about his shameless hawking of worthless goods. And since I'm talking about this money culture that we're in, you know, I want to bring up that most Patriot, or a lot of Patriot and alternative radio, is all about selling something as much as about telling something. You know, a great example of this is over at Republic Broadcasting, where, and I'm not trying to knock Republic Broadcasting because I lost my program there, but because it's no different from all the others. They're all like this. The only one that isn't is Voice of Reason, because there's no commercials on Voice of Reason. There's no commercial advertising. But everybody else has it, and some of them, like Alex Jones and Jeff Rentz and that, they've got stuff they're selling like crazy, and they've got ads all over their sites, and they don't really care whether it's any good or not, which is the way it is with all people who take money from advertisers. If they pay the money, then they get a spot there. So, but anyway, at Republic Broadcasting, the man who took over the slot that I was in, John Stokes, I noticed that he was selling right from the day one. You know, he's selling nonstop. And he would talk about things that he could sell stuff about. Like he talked in the beginning, I only listened to a couple of shows, and then I listened to a few segments later, here and there, and I listened to his last show after somebody told me about what happened there. Because he, last Tuesday, I think it was, yes, he was drunk on his program. His program was increased. John Stadtmiller liked him so much, I guess, that he increased him from 1 hour show from 8 to 9, from 8 to 10. So he had 2 hour show. And, I listened to the last hour because somebody told me that he was inebriated, and then they pulled him off the show, and that's exactly the truth. His speaking got so bad that you couldn't even understand a word he said, and he was slurring away, and then the break came, and then he didn't come back, and the guest finished the show. So then that was the last of John Stokes on RBN. But while he was still there, what he did when I listened to him, he would talk about all the cancers that were being caused by the Fukushima disaster. He was really big on Fukushima then. All these cancers were caused. Then he would tell you the products that he had that would counter it. And many others are doing the same thing. Many, many, many others. They talk about these disasters, and they talk about health problems, and then they're selling you stuff for the very thing that they're putting out as being what's happening to all of us. If you can't see through this, if people can't see through that, I don't know. I don't know why these people have so many listeners, because he wasn't even interesting, and he would spend large part of his program telling you where people were listening from. He had something where he knew that. He would say, oh, today we've got listener at, and he would name all these cities and states and go on and on for about 5 minutes. You'd think he was never going to stop. All these things just to fill up the time. So how he filled up 2 hours, I don't know, because I never listened to him for 2 hours. But he was, you could tell he was a drinker and a smoker, because he had this real throaty and rough laugh. But also, you can forgive all those things, I guess, if people want to listen to it, except all the sales that he was doing. And at RBN, an awful lot of programs are about selling things. And of course they're always selling gold and silver. And John Stokes has a website, and on his website, he has gold and silver price charts, and he has all his products that he sells, and then he talks a little bit. He has some news, and he also right now has two donation charts, where one for his web mistress and one for The Edge. And the one for the web mistress has been up for a while, and it's going to stay up until the end of January. And nothing has been given to that. It started around the 1st of November. And the one for The Edge has $25 when I looked yesterday, because that's this one I looked at his website yesterday. And it's going to go until the end of it. It's been up since the 1st of the month, and he's got only $25. So he's not doing too well, and I make the joke that maybe that's why he's drinking so hard. But I want to say, if I can find it here, that here's what he wrote on his website about his show. He says, as of Wednesday, November 23rd, 2011, The Edge with John Stokes is no longer with Republic Broadcasting. We were given no notice whatsoever. Well, I can agree with him there, because I wasn't given any notice either. So in that part, he's right. But he says, I don't operate that way. I man up. For now, we are exclusively live on the best network in radio, Orion Broadcasting Network, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Mountain Time. Contact your favorite network and tell them The Edge is available in that time slot, and we always come in the top 10 in the world, no matter what time slot we're in. The most happiest holidays for you and all those you love, as I truly love The Edge family, John. Well, You know, John calls him and his listeners a family. But, you know, what is he doing for his listeners? He's trying to sell them stuff. That's all he's doing. And he's not intelligent, and he doesn't have anything special, any special information for them. He fills up the time with this, that, and the other thing, a bunch of nothing. And he laughs. Well, a listener said that John's trademark is that he talks about dread diseases and then he laughs while he's laughing. And that's true. He talks about all these dread diseases while he's laughing about it. He's very strange man. Anyway, he's not on RBN anymore, but he's still on Orion. And the reason I wanted to talk about him was because he says, and he said often on his show, what great friends he was with Gordon Duff. And that they talk for hours on the phone, and they're just the best friends. And he thinks Gordon Duff is the greatest guy of all. So I'm going to talk a little bit about Gordon Duff once again, because these people are all so cynical. I mean, they must be laughing at their listeners and at their readers while they butter them up and try to get money out of them. Well, here's my music coming. So when we come back, if I don't have any callers, I will continue with this talking. I will continue talking about this radio program that had Gordon Duff.
We'll be right back with more on The Heretics Hour. You're listening to VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
We're learning now that NATO fire on the Pakistani base lasted for 2 hours. Islamabad says it even made the military alliance aware of who it was targeting. So how could this have happened? Where was there a breakdown?
This is a remarkable thing. This certainly is not a firefight in the fog of battle late at night. I think this was a deliberate attack. Now, I think there are various theories going around. Certainly the NATO forces knew it was a Pakistan base, but I think there were claims that that was firing at them. Now, there are several forces within that tribal areas. We're talking about linked to the Pakistan army, who... It's in their interest to provoke a firefight, because let's remember that really the interests of NATO and the interests of Pakistan are fundamentally different in this region. And therefore, you've had an uneasy alliance that's been together for over a decade. But really, the end goal of both groups are different. And I think this case now is much more serious than any of the other incidents. And there have been numerous incidents where NATO forces have had firefights with frontier corps of the Pakistan Army. But this is much more serious.
So going beyond all the rhetoric that we're seeing flying between the two sides, do you think the confrontation is that serious as it's being made out? Because there were past disagreements based on other incidents, and they eventually fizzled out and were diplomatically kind of massaged away. Do you think we could see that in this case?
Well, I think that both the United States and Pakistan have this very strange relationship that they need each other, and that probably before it absolutely ruptures, there will be some concessions. But, you know, the United States is planning to leave by 2014, all its troops there. What will be left behind? Pakistan is determined to have a force in Kabul that actually Pakistan wants to support it. In other words, a force similar to the Taliban that is Pashtun-based. This is quite opposed to anything that the West wants. So I think that the next 2 years are going to be fascinating when you've got two wholly different dynamics unfolding there.
There is a fresh buzz about a NATO program that actually pays Taliban insurgents $150 a month to go home and put down their weapons. Do you think that we are seeing warfare evolve here?
Well, remember, this strategy has been tried several times, and, you know, it hasn't worked. You know, the point about Afghanistan, and, you know, there was a very unflattering colonial statement about the Afghans that you can't buy an Afghan, but you can rent him. In other words, that you can, you know, gain loyalty for a short term, but after the...
Let's return to the Heretics Hour, brought to you by VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com. And now here's Carolyn.
Well, welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This last 10 minutes previous to the break was maybe a little confusing for you, thrown in there like that. But I am now going to go ahead, though, and talk some more about Gordon Duff, which some people probably think I shouldn't do. But I did listen to a program on RBN. I'm still talking about RBN. That took place November 6th. It's a Sunday morning program called Capital Forum. Now, I never listened to this, but somebody told me about some of the stuff that was on it. So I went and listened to it. And it was pretty amazing, and it sticks in my mind. So I thought, since I'm talking tonight about the money, you know, our culture, our money culture, which is so full of baloney, and we need to not pay attention to it, and also that the good things about National Socialism, which would have prevented all of this horror that's taking place today in our world, if it had been allowed to prosper as it should have been allowed to do, or I wish it would have been allowed to do, this kind of stuff wouldn't be going on. But here we have this woman who hosts Capital Forum. I understand she's a Jewess. She sounds a little crazy. She's probably a nice enough lady, but she has a very high-pitched voice, and she sounds a little weird, but she has a male partner who sounds more normal. But they had Gordon Duff on their program as a guest for 2 hours on November 6th, and he said so many strange things. I'm just going to read out here what I had written down from it. He started right out in the beginning saying that the white supremacist Nazi movement in the United States is after him, as well as Abe Foxman's Anti-Defamation League. So he says they're coming at him from both sides, from opposite directions. And he calls the Anti-Defamation League the Anti-Jewish League, because he says that they're really out to hurt the Jews. They want to make the Jews believe that there's an enemy, a Nazi or a Muslim behind, underneath their beds or something that they should be afraid of. This is the way Duff pretends that, well, Duff is a multiculturalist in the first place. He believes in anti-Semitism. I mean, he thinks that there is such a thing as anti-Semitism and that the Jews are targeted. And so he's calling, but he doesn't want Abe Foxman's Anti-Defamation League to be, he doesn't want you to think that those are Jews, because he says that they're anti-Jewish. They're just a few of those crazy bad Jews, that this is the way Duff will put it. Now, he will put it that everything everything that's bad, like Nazis, is after the Jews and or against the Jews. And the Jews are the good guys and white supremacists are the bad guys. Okay. Now, this is this runs through everything that he writes. And I imagine that since John Stokes loves Duff so much, and John Stadtmiller seems to like him too, that they must agree with that too. Now, Duff then said, tells us, as I knew, and he said many times before, that he's of mixed racial heritage, which he calls a typical American. You know, he makes the point over and over when it comes up that a typical American, or even an American is a mixed heritage, even mixed racial person. And so he points out how mixed up he is. He says on his mother's side, he says, this is a quote, on my mother's side, they're, of course, Jewish, and not just Jewish, Jewish and Cherokee Indian. Then he laughs. I never heard that Cherokee Indian before. I don't know if he just added that. Because you see, in my opinion, Gordon Duff is a kind of a pathological liar because he seems to enjoy lying so much. I mean, he tells a lot of lies. They have to be lies because it changes. He changes it. Now, he used to say that his mother was partly Jewish, but now his mother's Jewish and Jewish and Cherokee Indian. I guess that means partly. Now, his paternal grandmother, he says, is certainly German. And then he adds, I live in Germany and my children are there. I've heard him say that before. He doesn't live in Germany, but his children, he's got, I don't know, maybe two, because he says children, are there. Are they working there? Are they stationed with the U.S. military there? But anyway, he says they live there. I don't disbelieve that, but I would say that he lives there, although he does do business there. He's got, according to him, what I've read, he's got several businesses that he's busy making some pretty good money in. Export, import, export, and some stuff where he's got partners in Europe here and there. Some of it is financial. Some of it, I think, is import, export products. So he's if that's even true, if that's true, but that's what I've read. Now, and he said it. Now, now this makes him, you know, an expert on Germany. He thinks he's an expert on Germany. He calls himself German often enough. And he thinks he can talk about National Socialism, and which he's way off the beam when he talks about that. It's just gossip that he repeats. But anyway, here's some of the things he said. He claimed that Abe Foxman's favorite nephew is his longtime friend and works for him. And he spent some time trying to convince listeners that the ADL was pursuing him. Well, I already talked about that. Now he says that the ADL is after him because they wrote an article about Duff and Jim Fetzer and Kevin Barrett all together and accused them of being, you know, anti-Semites and so on, anti-Israel and so on. That's the last I've heard about that. But Duff keeps bringing it up. It's a badge of honor for him. He keeps trying to convince people that the ADL is after him. But they're really not. Now, I was written up by the ADL, and I never said a word about it, unlike Duff, who never quits talking about it. Now, trying to defend his Libya position, which he's been highly criticized for, and lost a lot of supporters over that, but he can't go back on it, so now he spent a lot of time tearing into. I'm turning my microphone around. Tearing into Gaddafi, and he says, but in the middle of that, he says Gaddafi's oil advisor was a former business partner of his out of Switzerland. You know, this is the way he talks. Everybody that he talks about is somebody that he knows or somebody important in their organization. He knows or works for him or whatever. He uses this to explain his inside information. And he says, I worked with the Gaddafi family when I was a banker. And he says, I knew Gaddafi and got along quite well with him. Gaddafi was a 33rd degree Mason. Whether all this is true or not, I don't know. But I don't know I've never heard Gaddafi talk about him. Also, he says, here's some more of his bragging. He says the head of the CIA bought put options on airline stocks ahead of the 9/11 attacks. He was the cousin of one of my best friends. Then he says, I was close friends with the chief exorcist of the Catholic Church. He said all this on this program. And he agreed with the caller who said that the Vatican is run by Luciferians. And he said he agreed with that 300%. And he repeated again that he's an atheist. And he said, I was a UN diplomat for 5 years with the rank of ambassador. Now, I've got a message here. Let's see. I have to take a look at it. Okay. I don't know why people send me these reminders I don't need. Now, he claimed that he gets his information from secret intelligence reports leaked to him by his inside sources at the CIA. According to John Stokes, Duff told Stokes that he works as an independent contractor for the CIA. And he said this on this program. I quote, Dick Cheney led a special operations group which threatened members of Congress with killings. Obama's family was also threatened with death. And then he kind of said, oh, I didn't really pretend like I didn't say that. I tell the advertisers not to cancel out on the show here because I said that. And he was acting like he had given out this real inside information about Dick Cheney, but he probably shouldn't have done it. And then the hosts were playing up to that with him. It was all such a ridiculous thing. You know, he goes after the Bush Cheney administration like nobody's business. He really hates Republicans. In fact, we'll get into this right here. He likes to make the CIA the number one bad guy. He links it to the Rothschilds and the Freemasons and the Bush family, who, according to him, were Nazis. He always brings back at every opportunity he gets, and he did it on this show. He starts telling the listeners and the hosts about the Bush's relations with how they financed Adolf Hitler and the Nazis, and they were Nazis. And he says that the Republican Party of today are the Nazis in the United States. And he says the Republican Party is the evil empire. And I believe he even said he'd like to see all Republicans put to death. He said something like that. Every Republican should be hung if he had anything to do with it. Something like that. But I didn't go back and find that particular phrase. It gets a little tedious. He defends Obama. He always defends Obama. And he defended Obama on this program. And he made the comment that I have seen him do brilliant things. He says, well, Obama is good and he's bad. He does some bad things, but I've seen him do some brilliant things. And so he's not against Obama. He tries to defend him. He actually defends. Sometimes I have thought that he just plain works for the Democrat Party. It's nothing more than that, because he's always bringing the problem back to the Republicans and the Bushes and tries to make that Bush administration the source of all the evil in the United States. Prescott Bush is the source of the Nazi infiltration of the United States back after World War II. So this is a theme that he's always going after, which is why he gets my attention the way he does. Now, he also said that he's a disabled veteran. I never myself before heard that he ever claimed to be disabled, but he said he was disabled. And yet he travels around the country on a motorcycle. He talked about that, too. And he's a supporter of Occupy Wall Street. He said, it's the first sign of life in the U.S. in 40 years. That's his comment. Well, they said, why do you support Occupy Wall Street? He said, well, you know, it's the first sign of life in the United States in 40 years. And then he's laughing about that and kind of going on a little here and there about that. So, you know, I say... what is the agenda of this man, Gordon Duff? If you get down to the bottom line of it, it's to destroy America, because he is so anti-American in the wrong way. I don't like much about America today, but he wants to destroy Christian America. He wants to destroy everybody's belief in it. He promotes multicultural America. That's what he promotes, and he promotes it openly. And the same agenda that the Jews have. So, maybe he's working for the Jews in the Democratic Party or something like that. But in any event, maybe he's working for several people. I'm gonna stop here and take a caller who's been on the line and see what he has to say about these things I'm just talking about. And that is, I think, Leslie. Leslie, are you there still?
It's kind of hard to know where to start with Gordon Duff, but I think you... John Stokes made a comment on his show today that Israel is suicidal. That sounds like something he got from Duff. It's always, you know... And another, they say that ADL, you know, is the enemy of Israel. That's another Duff. And of course, yeah. Israel is an enemy of the Jews. And then that goes together with, you know, Hitler was the enemy of Germany, basically.
You said John Stokes said on his program today. You're listening to him. What program are you listening to on Oracle?
Orion.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So he's now what I listened to of him. Here's what I want to say. If he's saying those things, if he really is talking regularly with Gordon Duff, and he is such an idiot, John Stokes, then Gordon Duff is spending his time putting out his line to people like John Stokes, who has a radio program. He used to have two, now he's got one. But he's on every day, and people listen. So I guess Gordon Duff spends a lot of his time. He must be a very energetic guy. I have to say that for him. He spends a lot of his time giving these lines to these people, people like John Stokes, who are flattered by the attention of the important Gordon Duff. You know, Duff has made him. He's built himself up to appear to people to be an important person in the world of political commentary or whatever. When if you really listen to him very long, you see he's got some kind of mental problems, or he's an idiot, or he's a liar, or all three put together. So go on. Is what you're saying about Stokes, that he's listening to Duff.
Well, I mean, yeah. Duff is a political commentator, that's true. He's a so-called disabled veteran, that's true. But all of his other stories about, he's made claims where he's going to Middle Eastern countries and meeting with the head diplomats and advising them. It's silly. He's made so many claims of how many very, very, I don't believe any of his stories, you know, about these business interests that he has in Europe and Germany and such. I don't believe any of that. I don't believe that he and his children live in Germany. I just think the man is just so full of lies that there's just nowhere to begin with him.
I agree. I'm glad you put it that way. And I think a lot of people agree with that now. I think he's lost a lot of his support. He came on like gangbusters, and everybody thought that Veterans Today was just the greatest, but it's really lost a lot of ground. I'm going to go ahead and say, I don't want to, I'm just going to mention, because I have to tell the rest of this story, that, Ingrid Rimland Zundel is a columnist for Veterans Today, much to my chagrin. But she seems to like Gordon. She sticks with him, even though a lot of people have left him. And I think they consider having her there a coup, and she must enjoy the attention or something. But anyway, the last article that she wrote that she has written there is called Dictators and Despots I Have Known. And I think it's been kind of a flop because when I looked yesterday, it had still only received 7 comments instead of the usual 40 or 50 or 80 or something of earlier ones. It's not a very good article. It doesn't say much of anything. And of these, I just wanted to bring this up because I want to say what Jim Dean. Now, Jim Dean is Gordon Duff's, you know, second in command, sort of, you know, it's another main guy there. And he gets into the comments when he thinks that they need some help or he needs to help out the author, whatever. And so of those 7 comments, he wrote 2 of them. And all those comments are not about the article, but people are discussing something among themselves about the SOA, basically, which was something copied at the end of the article. So the last comment that Dean made, well, it took a long time to get to this. He wrote this: Gordon is the one with all the history degrees over here. 2 masters and a PhD, European, Asian, and African. Not sure which is which, but a lot of his UN work was in Africa. Refuge and development work, which is how he got his UN ambassadorship and special delegate status, a lifetime designation. He's been a busy boy. I was astonished at this. I've never heard that Gordon Duff has a PhD. And in history? I can't believe it. I don't believe it. He has to show this to me because I'm saying I don't believe it. And like with Elie Wiesel's tattoo, I need to see it to believe it. So I'm saying show us your PhD degree, Mr. Duff. What do you say?
Gordon Duff makes Elie Wiesel look like a Boy Scout. I mean, Elie Wiesel's got a couple of huge lies. Of course, now Wiesel's made $1 million off of his.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't say that. I'd say they're both kind of similar in a lot of ways, but Wiesel's in a lot bigger. He's in a lot bigger company there. I mean, I can't come up with the word, but you know, he's in the big time. Well, Gordon's is not in that kind of big time. He'd like to be. But this idea that he's got a 2 master's degree and a PhD in history, when his history is absolutely the weakest part of what he writes about.
No, I mean, there's another guy. Maybe I shouldn't mention this. There's another guy that tells stories constantly. And, you know, when I first started listening to him, I thought he sounded very credible to me. And it took me months. And what I finally did was I added up all of his stories. And there's just no way that all the things that he has claimed to have done in his lifetime, when I actually made a list of them, and there was no way possible, you know, in a lifetime to have done all of the things that he claims to have done and to live all of the places he's claimed to live. And this is another guy. Any famous person you name, he either knew the man personally or one of his children went to school with their children. You know, it just goes on and on with these people. Pat, this is just a case of a liar that just can't stop. It's just one lie after another, and they just keep adding them as they go along. And if you make a list of them over a period of time, you'll see that these people just couldn't possibly have done all of the things that they claim that they've done and known all the people they've claimed. Because at one time they're in Africa, and then you'll hear them a couple of months later during that same time frame they were in Switzerland, or they're saying
something else. Well, maybe you should do that with Gordon Duff. Maybe you should go back. You have the time to do that. I'm not going to do it. And make a list of all these things he said. But there's a pretty long list here tonight of stuff that he has said, which is just kind of ridiculous. That, you know, everything that comes up, he's got a friend there. Here, the head of the CIA was a cousin of one of his best friends. We don't know who the head of the CIA, he doesn't say who this head was, just the head of the CIA, you know? So that, and he's close friends with the chief exorcist of the Catholic Church. Well, I would say, I hope this is the last I'm going to talk about Gordon Duff, but it's part of exposing the kind of stuff that so many people believe and still follow, and you still have people reading on his site, oh, Gordon, this was a great article. You're really doing the greatest work here. And, you know, what he's done with that Libya Gaddafi business, he was constantly saying on this Capital Forum program that Gaddafi was a scumbag, slime bag, who murdered, you know, all of his people, murdered thousands of people or millions of people or whatever, is responsible for all these deaths and crimes and so on. He was no good. He just went on and on like that to slander the guy. And then he'll come up and say, well, he's in league with Israel. And see, Duff gets all of his credibility because he's anti-Israel. And so all these anti-Israel people think that he's doing some good work. Whereas it's really some kind of an infiltration kind of a deal is what he's doing. But I don't think he's going to last too much longer.
I'll admit, I don't know what his motivation is. I can't figure that out, what he's trying to do. Maybe other than just get attention. I don't know.
Oh, well, I think he's an agent of some kind.
Well, I can understand why you think he's Jewish. He certainly kind of operates that way. It's just
You think he's lying about being Jewish.
Yes.
Well, that's interesting. You know what? We've come to the end of the show. Thank you, Leslie, and thank you, listeners, for listening to this rather unusual show. By the way, my guest next week is going to be... Oh, I missed out saying it again.
Thanks for listening. The Heretics Hour returns Monday evening, 9 p.m. Eastern U.S. time. Join us at ReasonRadioNetwork.com.